And our sermon text this Sunday before our national holiday, found in Romans 13, verses 1 to 7, found on page 948 in your pew Bible. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For the same reason you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. Well, with the approach of the 4th of July, I want to ask you, did our founding fathers transgress the substance of this passage just read for you in the Revolutionary War? By throwing off the chains of British colonialism, did they disobey God by refusing to submit to the then governing authorities, that is, the British Crown? This debate has immediacy for me because my kids in Texas, land of the free, home of the Lone Star, my kids Gideon and Rachel Harris find themselves under the ministry of an OPC pastor who I dearly love, Young Buck. We need young bucks in the ministry in the OPC, and Andrew is one, Andrew Moody. But he takes this passage to affirm the above about our country. That is, it was founded illegitimately, the United States of America. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, all the founders were being disobedient to God in rebelling against the mother country. In fact, this minister went so far, dear Andrew, as to state in a Facebook post, and I had to keep from chucking Debbie's computer out the window, that he would have been compelled by this passage to take the side of the Tories. Now, I must admit that a shallow, cursory reading of this passage might render such a view. I toyed with it myself in my younger days. It is a popular one. John MacArthur, for example, pastor of Grace Community Church, host of Grace to You, author of many books that have blessed me and sharpened my exegesis. He says the following. People have mistakenly linked democracy and political freedom to Christianity. And that's why many contemporary evangelicals believe the American Revolution was completely justified, both politically and scripturally. They follow the arguments of the Declaration of Independence, which declares that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are divinely endowed rights. And he finishes by saying, but such a position is contrary to the clear teachings and commands of Romans 13. So, the United States was actually born out of a violation of New Testament principles. And that's his position. It's espoused, this view is espoused, really, by many Reformed men, too. Not just Andrew Moody in San Antonio. Dr. Daryl Cornett, who is a professor at Mid-America Theological Seminary, one of the few that I recommend to those pursuing ministry, he says, deistic and Unitarian tendencies in regard to religion were of such strength that even Orthodox Christians were swept up into rebellion against their governing authorities, he says. Those Christians who supported physical resistance against the tyranny of Britain generally turned to Enlightenment rhetoric. That was at this point that I wanted to check Debbie's for validation propped up by poor exegesis and application of the Bible, unquote. Well, are these men right? Is my colleague Andrew in San Antonio on course in his biblical exegesis and teaching my kids? Well, let's examine our text today in its context as well. All right? In the broader context of Scripture as well. Okay. You have 3 points there. We're only going to get to one today. Part two next week. But I want to give you a sense for the fullness of background there is to this text in the life of the church, okay? And in the life and study of our founding fathers, too. Well, the essence of determining context in any passage, sometimes this one is kind of amplified, taken out of its context, pasted on the wall, and set off by itself. And if you do that, perhaps you can arrive at some of these conclusions. But context is very important to Romans chapter 13. And it is here where it is because of what Paul has just exhorted his Roman brothers to do in verses 19 to 21. Let's read those here and put it in context back up to chapter 12. Beginning at about verse 19, he says, "Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine. I will repay,' saith the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink, for by doing so you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So don't avenge yourselves. Leave the wrath of God to God." Right? "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." Well, this resonates very clearly, does it not, with a terror of the state and the magistrate, a servant of God, as the avenger who carries out God's wrath, which we see clearly in verse 4. Do you see this? Do you see this, please? Our pacifist brothers, and they are brothers. I love Andrew. He's been such a blessing to our kids. But he's wrong on this. Our pacifist brothers are compelled to ignore the context to establish their point. Do not do this. You do not do this. Implicit also is the nature of biblical good and evil, as evidenced by verse 21. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. We are to practice good as well in order to be blessed by the magistrate. And fear, indeed, if we do evil, because the magistrate is God's instrument of wrath. He bears not the ermine cloak, bears not the foxtail, as Luther would say. No, he bears not the sword by which blood is shed in vain. This avenger, the governing authorities, they do so upon the basis of good and evil. That's exactly why magistrates are not a terror to those who do good, but are to those who do evil. All of this presupposes an objective standard of good and evil. Implicit here is, what if they bear the sword on behalf of evil? Then all collapses, does it not? Your doing good is countenanced as evil by them. Your doing evil is countenanced as doing good. All is inverse. What if they bear the sword on behalf of evil? And what if they themselves avenge not God, but their own narcissistic wills, as tyrants do? Those who absolutize this text, then, have no answer to these questions, I submit to you, except blind obedience. The context of Romans 13 is a clear prohibition of fanatical vigilantism in the style of the Jewish zealots of Paul's day. Do not take personal vengeance on your enemies. Do not exact justice yourselves personally. That's why the state is there, and its apparatus of justice are there, to exact punishment on the wicked and approve those who do good. In fact, the Roman historian Tacitus chronicles an empire-wide tax revolt. Imagine that, a tax revolt. At about the time of the composition of Romans by Paul as well, Jewish zealots were a part of this rebellion. Perhaps Paul has this in mind. We have no way of knowing for sure. But he was no doubt familiar with the zealots of Rome, of Israel at that time, the Jewish zealots. So, with this context in mind, that is, eschew personal tribal vigilantism against enemies, but rather bring it to the magistrate for resolution. We see this principle passed down to us in Western law, too, canonized in Western law. Paul exhorts us to be subject, that is, to submit to the governing authorities. The Greek word used there is hupotasso. Hupotasso. We see this word frequently, this verb frequently in the scriptures. It means to submit, to be subject unto. The same verb used in Christians submitting to your spiritual leaders, 1 Corinthians 16. Submit to one another in Ephesians 5, 12. Slaves, submit to your master, Titus chapter 2 and 9. Yet many of those, parenthetically, who hold that we should submit to the government recoil at the notion of slaves submitting to their masters. Oh, that's old-fashioned, the abolition movement, for example. And the submission is one of principle here, too. Government, when it is doing its function, bearing the sword against evil and on behalf of good, is to be submitted unto. That is a matter of conscience, Paul says later in the text, does he not? Now, contrary to Dr. MacArthur, much of our notion of law and order is derived from the Bible, is derived from the rich cultural heritage we have in the text built up over millennia. Our idea of Western law and order is derived directly from this passage and principle. How many American Westerns? I love American Westerns. How many American Westerns are filmed on this premise, too? One of my favorites, Clint Eastwood's Hang 'Em High. Perfect example. The judge says to Clint Eastwood, you know, if you want to avenge yourself on the guys who tried to hang you, and that's how the movie opens up, with him being hung for a crime he did not commit, and so he goes out on a mission to avenge himself. The judge says, no, if you want to avenge yourself on these guys, put on this badge. And he hands him a deputy's badge, right? Because he can kill two birds with one stone. Not only get these criminals, but get himself a good deputy in the bargain. Put on this badge and bring them to justice under objective law, not personal revenge. That is the overall principle at work here. Not blind, craven obedience to the state, no matter what they say and order you to do. That's a shallow interpretation of this text. And several observers also see an importance in Paul's choice of words here, too. Submit versus obey. Submission always required. Obedience, it ain't necessarily so. It depends, we might say. Doug Moo, in his commentary, very fine commentary, I highly recommend it to you on this subject. He brings some good thought and background and culture to it too. He says to submit is to recognize one's place in a hierarchy, to acknowledge as a general rule that certain people or institutions have authority over us. The kind of blind, thoughtless obedience extrapolated, it's lazy too. It's theologically and ethically lazy. The kind of blind, thoughtless obedience extrapolated by many from this text is not taught here. It's a cop-out. It's lazy exegesis, lazy thinking. It surrenders the mind to the state. It gives up the individual conscience to the collective group and state. Who can discern, much less resist, evil when such a mindset prevails? There are three broad positions derived from Scripture on resistance to an evil civil magistrate. Nobody's arguing that one should submit to a righteous magistrate who is practicing implicit biblical law, implicit biblical righteousness. But what happens when you have an evil civil magistrate? Three different views prevail. Once again, Moo, if you want to read him, he breaks it down into seven different. But you don't have to do that. There are three broad general views. That is the King James Anabaptist model. It's the King James model because King James, the same King James who authorized the translation of the Bible into English, he developed most thoroughly the idea of the divine right of kings over their subjects, the divine right of kings, right, which prevailed much longer than Republican democracy has over millennia, really. And it's kind of cravenly self-serving. But he commanded the Church of England to teach not only that kings rule in place of God over the people, but that those same subjects are to render complete submission and non-resistance to him as king. No resistance, never for any reason. And this, of course, demonstrates that although a man may command the translation of a Bible, it does not mean that he has a command of its understanding, does he? The second model is the passive resistance, if you will, the Daniel Gandhi Martin Luther King Jr. model. This model acknowledges that we must obey God rather than man, as we saw the midwives do this morning, and as Elijah did so graphically with the priests of Baal, and indeed as Peter declared to the Sanhedrin, we must obey God rather than man. But it does so passively, this view, this point of view. That is, it does not take up arms, but it rather refuses to obey commands contrary to Scripture and come what may, as Daniel did and as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. Yet this model only works, admittedly, too. Great insight by Gandhi here. This model works, admittedly, when there is a core of justice in the state. As there was in Rome, we've seen that unfolded in Acts. There is indeed a core of Roman justice, which roughly reflects biblical models of justice. Or England, too, core of biblical justice there in England. As Gandhi confesses, he said, "My model of passive resistance only achieved success precisely because it appealed to Britain's own values, its core value of justice. In an absolute tyranny," Gandhi says, "such as we see in the Soviet Union," right, contemporaries with the Soviet Union he was, "I would have disappeared." I would have disappeared, and he would he not? How many potential Gandhis were there in the Soviet Union or in China, for example, that have just disappeared, unknown to us, but known to God? The third position is armed resistance, founded upon the just war theory, articulated by the Reformers. And here we have principles for active armed force employed to achieve the ends for which the Bible prescribes it. And these principles were not drawn out of a hat, but from the heads of saints who wrestled with this question all of their lives. And this includes our founding fathers. St. Augustine is probably the one who developed most fully what has come down to us as the just war theory. Although he wasn't trying to hone a theory per se so that West Point's cadets could have something to teach and learn. Well, St. Augustine was profoundly affected by the invasion of Rome by Alaric the Goth in AD 410. And in response, he composed his magisterial, The City of God. When many thinkers in the Roman Empire tended to blame Christianity for the weakening of old Rome. Well, in The City of God, Augustine distills and summarizes the thought of many Christian thinkers concerning who, where, when, and how war should be fought, especially since the ascendancy of Constantine, who now, rather than having the sword at his throat, had the sword in his hand. What do we do now, now that we bear the sword? Augustine comes back with five principles of just war. Number one, war's aim should be to restore and establish peace. And he anchors this and grounds this in Scripture as well, as well as the thinking of the church over the centuries. War's aim should be to restore and establish peace. As contradictory as it may sound, initially, the shalom of God, the peace of God, is the aspiration of the magistrate who conducts the war. He says, peace should be the object of your desire, Augustine says. War should be waged only as a necessity and waged only that through it God may deliver men from that necessity. That is, war is to be fought to deliver men from war. Even in the course of war, Augustine says, you should cherish the spirit of a peacemaker. That's hard to do. It flies in the face of those ambitious princes, however, who seek to increase their princedoms. It flies in the face of tyrants who seek riches and power. It flies in the face of Marxist dictators who seek to create a workers' paradise. And, dare I say, flies in the face of those who want to spread democracy all over the world. In our own case, Britain was the aggressor, breaking the peace of the colonies at places like the Boston Massacre or Lexington and Concord. Hostilities were already underway at the time of the Revolution. And the aim of the war was to restore and establish peace under the Articles of Confederation. The second principle of the just war theory is that war must be waged to vindicate justice, to right a previous wrong. You see the principle of justice. You see the principle of right and wrong in our text, do you not? This principle is derived from it and others like it. Has an army invaded you? Has a prince or a tyrant subjected one people to slavery? Has a prince systematically robbed and pillaged you? All of these and more are a violation of justice and justification for defending oneself. Those wars may be defined as just, Augustine says, those wars may be defined as just which requite injuries. But these violations of justice must be egregious violations of justice, not mere pretense. It was precisely the object of our own Declaration of Independence to do this. This is clearly in the minds of the founders and in the mind as well of Jefferson as he composed the Declaration of Independence, that is to articulate the wrongs visited on the colonists and vindicate biblical justice. He says, we all know this one, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's usually where it stops. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for any light and transient causes. And he has it here in mind, the idea that you resist for egregious wrongs. Okay? Not for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, which indeed our colonists' forefathers endured, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, that is evil. It is their right, it is their duty, he says, taking once again the charge of duty from passages like this one. It is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. And then he goes on to articulate some of the usurpations and abuses to which they were subject, page after page of them. So we won't trouble you with those right now, but suffice it to understand that indeed the revolution was undertaken to right injustices, one of the principles of the just war theory. Okay? On the other hand, Adolf Hitler was looking for a pretense to annex Poland, and he used the excuse of the oppression of enclaves of German peoples there to invade her. Implicit and explicit in this point is an appeal to this text, that is, that a magistrate is charged with vindicating the good and punishing the evil. So consequently, the colonial governors were charged with defending the colonists with the sword, calling up the militias. The colonial legislatures were charged with supplying and constituting colonial militias to defend against the predations of King George, all under the heading of this second principle. Thirdly, The third principle of the just war. War must be waged by properly constituted authorities. Once again, this text, the one in 1 Peter chapter 2 as well. And once more with Romans 13 in mind, Augustine and the Reformers and our founders recognized the illegitimacy of vigilantes, right? This is what is dealt with in chapter 12. Don't be a vigilante in exacting vengeance and justice. They rejected vigilantes like would later crop up with John Brown prior to the Civil War, the Anabaptist Thomas Munzer, who led a peasants' uprising during the Reformation. Luther hated this. He categorically rejected it. He advocated its ruthless suppression by the German princes. And especially the non-state jihadist we see today throughout the Islamic world. Non-state actors, as our State Department calls them. So this is precisely why our founding fathers established committees of correspondence. Those of you who know your American history, they were established prior to the Revolutionary War, later morphed into the Continental Congress of the Revolution, to coordinate the efforts of the 13 colonial legislatures. They were, that is, properly constituted authorities. Without this, we would not have rebelled or resisted. Indeed, our war of independence was waged by such, that is, properly constituted authorities. Number four, the fourth principle of just war, and these principles are not all just sucked out of and derived from chapter 13 here, but cross-scriptural, Genesis to Revelation, not just one isolated text. The extreme atrocities of war, number four, the extreme atrocities of war must be minimized, if not eliminated altogether. The extreme atrocities of war must be minimized, if not eliminated altogether. It's a corollary of justice that is found in this text. There should be no wanton violence, no desecration of temples or churches, no looting, rape, massacre, atrocities, reprisals, and the slaughter of non-combatants. That principle has come down to us in the idea of the euphemism, no collateral damage, right? We hear that all the time. There should be no collateral damage when we hit with drone strikes. That's a principle right out of number four here. Yet it is precisely the manner in which King George's Redcoats conducted themselves. It is the manner in which the Redcoats conducted themselves. And it was the impulse for several of the first 10 amendments. What is amendment number three? Do you know your amendments? Amendment number three. No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Number three, right? Quartering was exactly the condition which spawned so many of the atrocities of the colonial period. The fifth principle of a just war, that is, war is conducted by soldiers, not civilians. Things like assassins, roving bands of civilians, as there was in the Crusade, the Peasants' Crusade, was a terrible atrocity. And clergy, too, were forbidden from taking up arms. This is why the Geneva Conventions require humane treatment of uniformed soldiers, that is, those properly enlisted, trained, and armed for war. All others fall outside of the protection of the Geneva Conventions, and rightly so. So, these principles, five, compose the theory of a just war. And as imperfectly followed as they often are, critics can throw mud at this all day because it has been imperfectly followed. Nevertheless, has informed the church ever since. So these two men are just wrong. It isn't derived strictly from Enlightenment rhetoric for validation. Nor did they prop up their positions with poor exegesis. They haven't done their homework if they say this. And poor application of the Bible. They have not done their exegesis either if they say things like this. Rather, the founders turned to the whole counsel of the Bible. The reformers turned to the whole counsel of the Bible rather than one passage. One of the weaknesses of the pacifism position is that it relies upon a few isolated texts, narrowly interpreted, made absolute over all others. This text, for example, is taken out of its context, It is, as we've said, a general principle for God's purpose for government, that is to administer objective biblical justice backed by force so that the personal tribal vengeance need not be visited on society. What an anarchistic culture and society we would have. And then this text, taken out of its context, is made absolute over all other texts. For instance, Old Testament texts where the innocent are delivered, like in Judges or by King David or the Hebrew midwives, where self-defense is sanctioned, where magistrates are strictly exhorted to apply justice equally, sometimes with blood. One of the other texts often appealed to is that in the Sermon on the Mount. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 to 42 for a minute. One of those other texts that are absolutized, verses 38 to 42. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would see you, sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. Once again, not putting this text in its context, you end up with as Brian so poignantly shared with us during a Sunday school lesson, a brother who says, well, if a guy breaks into my house, rapes my wife, kills my kids, and steals all that I have to let him do it. That's foolishness. There is a time for everything. Wisdom tells you when this text applies in the context of sharing the gospel. It is not to be made absolute. You are a fool if you hold that position and you would do those things. So it is with this one, too. Do not absolutize this text and make it pay all the freight for the rest of Scripture. Ignored completely by the pacifist is the duty of both state and individual to administer justice, which by definition demands resistance to tyrants. In fact, the oft-quoted phrase of the Revolution, resistance to tyrants is obedience to God, attributed to Jefferson, some to Franklin, is a direct product of the exegesis of texts like these and the understanding of all the texts of the Bible. This is the product of the Reformation. You remember. I remember very fondly. I was perked up, really, when I heard Dr. Beakey reflecting with us when he was here on the fruit of the study of the Puritans. Right? The Puritans were systematic in all they did. In studying the Bible. They did a systematic, thorough study of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation on the entirety of marriage and family. Remember Dr. Beakey understanding that with us, bringing that before us. In contrast to the Roman Catholic Church, the Puritans set their minds in faith that the Bible could teach what God had in mind for marriage and family by examining it closely in the Bible and then applying the Bible from Genesis to Revelation to family. Well, wonder of wonders, they did the same with the Bible and government. Unlike shallow evangelicalism and a Baptist pacifist strain of thinking, the Reformers and Puritans brought the entirety of the Bible to bear on this issue. In keeping with the principles of the just war, both Luther and Calvin, for example, derived from the entirety of Revelation that resistance to tyranny by a properly constituted magistrate. Coming out of this text, for Luther, it was Frederick the Wise, the German elector of Saxony. For Calvin, it was Prince Condé of Bourbon in France, properly constituted magistrates who resisted militantly. But it had to be a properly constituted magistrate, even though it be a lesser magistrate. Was entirely biblical and at times utterly necessary. Necessary. Luther, in his inimical way, says the wise apostle does not tell us he bears a foxtail efficaciously. No, he rather bears a sword by which blood is shed. Not a foxtail, a sword. This is especially true when matters of conscience are involved. You don't turn off your conscience. Oh, yeah. Whatever Obama says, I do, because I owe honor to him. An automaton. This is especially true when matters of conscience are involved. Luther advocated that the German Protestant princes were obligated to defend their realms from the Pope and his armies, who regularly forced the people to partake of the Eucharist. Calvin, while serving at Geneva, was under constant. We sometimes, when we study Calvin in Geneva, we forget the pall of threat that hung over Geneva the entire time they were making those reforms from the Catholic cantons in Switzerland. After Calvin died, there was indeed an invasion of the Geneva canton by some of the Roman Catholics. But Calvin nevertheless insisted that Geneva be prepared to defend itself, not passively resist. Next week, we'll see how John Knox, you want a hairy defender of the rights of the people, John Knox, read John Knox. People would come to watch him burn too in the pulpit. We'll see how Knox applies this to the revolution in Scotland too. It really bugs me that so many of our Reformed brethren love to take from the Scots solid Reformed doctrine, and indeed we drink deeply from the well of the Scots, except this part. Yet without their Reformed doctrine of resistance to tyranny, would the rest of Reformed doctrine have such a strong, deep well, such a fertile place to flourish? I ask you that. Well, from this rich heritage, then, our founders drew. And in many places, too, they went to get some of this. On the basis of these numerous historical theological writings, there were many of them, too, Americans embraced two specific theological positions that guided their thinking and their conduct in conflict with Great Britain. The first, most Christian denominations during the founding era held that while they were forbidden to overthrow the institution of government per se, as it's outlined here, and live in anarchy, consequently, they were not required to blindly submit to every law and policy. Those in the founding era understood that the general institution of government was unequivocally ordained by God, was not to be overthrown, but it did not mean that God approved of every specific government. God had ordained government in lieu of anarchy. He opposed anarchy, rebellion, lawlessness, and wickedness. He wanted civil government in society. Texts like this one demonstrate that for us. In fact, Reverend Jacob Duché, who's, you got to look up this sermon online. He says, inasmuch as all rulers are in fact the servants of the public and appointed for no other purpose than to be a terror to evildoers, a praise to them that do well, right out of our text. Whenever this divine order is inverted, whenever these rulers abuse their sacred trust by unrighteous attempts to injure, oppress, and enslave those very persons from whom alone under God their power is derived, does not humanity, does not reason, does not Scripture call upon the man, the citizen, the Christian of such a community to stand fast in that liberty wherewith Christ had made him free? John Quincy Adams also said, because as these things progressed, especially as the war progressed, Americans embraced this biblical position. Others would argue that you were advocating anarchy and rebellion. Well, John Quincy Adams says, there is no anarchy. The people of North American Union of its constituent states were associated bodies of civilized men and Christians in a state of nature, but not of anarchy. They were bound by the laws of God, which they all, and by all the laws of the gospel, which they all acknowledge as to be the rules of their conduct, unquote. So our founding fathers did not see themselves in this way at all. Well, the second scriptural viewpoint that they held fast in their vision, overwhelmingly embraced by most Americans during the Revolutionary era, was that God would not honor an offensive war, but he would honor a defensive war. Illustrative of this belief was that famous command to the Lexington Minutemen, right? You all learn in your history classes, not anymore, except for you homeschool kids, don't fire unless fired upon. Right? Derives from this principle. Yet having been fired upon without having broken any law, the Americans believed that they had a biblical right to self-defense, and they do. one of our founding fathers, James Wilson, a signer of both the Declaration and the Constitution, later a justice on the Supreme Court, says the defense of oneself. The defense of oneself. I'm going to do a sermon on the biblical rationale for the Second Amendment too. And the defense of oneself is one that's derived from this principle. Is not, nor can it be, abrogated by any regulation of municipal law. This principle of defense is not confined merely to the person, the idea of self-defense. It extends to the liberty and property of a man. It is right and good to defend your property. It is not confined merely to his own person. It extends to the persons of all those to whom he bears a particular relation, of his wife, of his parent, of his child. Would you not defend your children, your wife, from such predators? As a man is justified in defending, so he is justified in retaking his property. Man does not exist for the sake of government, but government is instituted for the sake of man. We have that inverted in our own day, do we not? And this text is twisted and perverted to substantiate that position. Well, our founders saw themselves then in a defensive war, if you will. And Reverend Witherspoon, who also signed the Declaration, he said, on the part of America, there was not the most distant thought of subverting the government. And you have to understand this, too, in the progress of leading up to the Revolution. On the part of America, there was not the most distant thought of subverting the government or of hurting the interests of the people of Great Britain, but of defending their own privileges from unjust encroachment. There was not the least desire of withdrawing their allegiance from the common sovereign that was King George III till it became absolutely necessary. And indeed, it was his own choice, Witherspoon says. So, Dr. Cornett's claim, those of John MacArthur, other critics, that the founders generally turned to Enlightenment rhetoric for validation propped up by poor exegesis and application of the Bible. Hogwash. Flapdoodle. They were biblical to their toenails in this. Just because these modern critics may disagree does not mean that, from an historical viewpoint, the Americans' approach was propped up by poor exegesis of the Bible or Enlightenment rhetoric for validation. Indeed, we learn from Scripture that government and its institutions have been instituted by God. Still in point one. Their authority is a derivative authority, isn't it? Given by God, whether those authorities recognize it or not. And as we will see more clearly next week, God has done this to restrain anarchy and ensure justice. What a blessing is good government when these things are acknowledged, is it not? What a blessing good government is when these things are acknowledged. As a good Calvinist, we are eager to affirm God's having ordained government, the consequent necessity of submitting to it, not only out of fear of punishment by that government, but because we have a conscience toward God over the very principle of government. But the submission is not a blind submission, wherein that God-given conscience is switched off. Rather, it is a conscience actively engaged with that government in living and promoting good behavior and discouraging and punishing bad behavior. By definition, if this is to be realized in the nation, the same good behavior must characterize the government, for heaven's sake. For heaven's sake, literally. All is broken otherwise. The implicit civil covenant is broken. Are you a good Calvinist? Are you a good reformed person? Then you must acknowledge a civil covenant. And it is broken when a government becomes unjust. And then it is incumbent upon the people as well as the princes to resist. In self-defense, if necessary, very well, and very vibrantly articulated by John Knox, too. And our text in no way precludes this. Christians, more than anyone, are alive to the will of God and His just demands, the demands of the law. Consequently, we have a deep, vast, and varied body of thinking on this field. The Reformed Church does. Including our own response to tyranny. Therefore, do not let anyone cloud your thinking on these issues. Resistance to tyrants is obedience to God. Well, let us now come to that place where we find our consciences. Is your conscience clear on this issue and others? We find our consciences relieved by grace.